Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 14. Seaton opened his eyes and gazed about him wonderingly. Only half-conscious, bruised and sore in every part, he could not remember what had happened. Instinctively drawing a deep breath, he coughed as the plus-pressure gas filled his lungs, bringing with it a complete understanding of the situation. He tore off his helmet and drew himself across to Dorothy's couch. She was still alive. He placed her face downward upon the floor and began artificial respiration. Soon he was rewarded by the coughing he had longed to hear. Snatching off her helmet, he seized her in his arms while she sobbed convulsively on his shoulder. The first ecstasy of their greeting over, she started guiltily. "Oh, Dick, see about Peggy. I wonder if..." "Never mind," Crane said. "She's doing nicely." Crane had already revived the stranger. Duquesne was nowhere in sight. Dorothy blushed vividly and disengaged her arms from around Seton's neck. Seton, also blushing, dropped his arms, and Dorothy floated away, clutching frantically at a handhold just out of her reach. "Pull me down, Dick," Dorothy laughed. Seton grabbed her ankle unthinkingly, neglecting his own anchorage, and they floated in the air together. Martin and Margaret, each holding a line, laughed heartily. "Tweet, tweet, I'm a canary," Seton said, flapping his arms. "Toss us a line, Mart." "A dicky bird, you mean," Dorothy said. Crane studied the floating pair with mock gravity. "That is a peculiar pose, Dick. What is it supposed to represent? Zeus sitting on his throne? I'll sit on your neck, you lug, if you don't get a wiggle on with that rope." As he spoke, however, he came within reach of the ceiling and could push himself and his companion to a line. Seton put a bar into one of the engines, and after flashing the warning light, applied a little power. The Skylark seemed to leap under them. Then everything had its normal weight once more. "Now that things have settled down a little," Dorothy said, "I'll introduce you two to Miss Margaret Spencer, a very good friend of mine. These are the boys I told you so much about, Peggy. This is Dr. Dick Seton, my fiancé. He knows everything there is to be known about atoms, electrons, neutrons, and so forth. And this is Mr. Martin Crane, who is a simply wonderful inventor. He made all these engines and things." "I may have heard of Mr. Crane," Margaret said eagerly. "My father was an inventor, too, and he used to talk about a man named Crane who invented a lot of instruments for supersonic planes. He said they revolutionized flying. I wonder if you are that Mr. Crane."
"Well, that is unjustifiably high praise, Miss Spencer," Crane replied, uncomfortable. "But as I have done a few things along that line, I could be the man he referred to."
"If I may change the subject," Seton said, "where's Duquesne?"
"He went to clean up. Then he was going to the galley to check damage and see about something to eat."
"Stout fella," Dorothy applauded. "Food, and especially about cleaning up, if you know what I mean, and I think you do. Come on, Peggy. I know where our room is."
"What a girl," Seton said as the women left, Dorothy half-supporting her companion.
"She's bruised and beat up from one end to the other. She's more than half-dead yet. She didn't have enough life left in her to flag a handcar. She can't even walk. She can just barely hobble. And did she let out one single yip? I ask to know. Business as usual all the way if it kills her. What a girl."
"Include Miss Spencer in that too, Dick. Did she let out any yips? And she was not in nearly as good shape as Dorothy was to start with."
"That's right," Seton agreed wonderingly. "Well, she's got plenty of guts, too. Those two women, Marty, my old and stinky chum, are blinding flashes and deafening reports. Well, let's go get a bath and shave and shove the air conditioners up a couple of notches, will you?" When they came back, they found the two girls seated at one of the ports.
"Did you dope yourself up, Dot?" Seaton asked.
"Yes, both of us. With amylophene. I'm getting to be a slave to the stuff." She made a wry face. Seaton grimaced too.
"So did we. Ouch. Nice stuff, that amylophene. But come over here and look out of this window. Did you ever see anything like it?"
As the four heads bent so close together, an odd silence fell upon the little group, for the blackness of the black of the interstellar void is not the darkness of an earthly night, but the absolute absence of light, a black beside which that of platinum dust is merely gray. Upon this indescribably black backdrop, there glowed faint patches which were nebulae. There blazed hard, brilliant, multicolored, dimensionless points of light, which were stars.
"Jewels on black velvet," Dorothy breathed. "Oh, gorgeous, wonderful."
Through their wonder, a thought struck Seaton. He leaped to the board. "Look here, Mart, I don't recognize a thing out there, and I wondered why. We're heading away from the Earth, and we must be making plenty of light speeds. The swing around that big dud was really something, of course, but the engine should have, or should it?"
"I think not. Unexpected, but not a surprise. That close to Roche's limit, anything might happen. Indeed, I guess we'll have to check for permanent deformations, but this object compass still works. Well, let's see how far we are away from home."
They took a reading, and both men figured the distance.
"Well, what do you make it, Mart? I'm afraid to tell you my result."
46.27 light centuries, Chuck.
"Chuck, we're up the well-known creek without a paddle. The time was 23:32 by the chronometer. Good thing you built it to stand going through a stone crusher. My watch is a total loss. They all are, I imagine. Now we'll read it again in an hour or so and see how fast we're going. I'll be scared witless to say that figure out loud, too."
"Dinner is announced," said Duquesne, who had been standing at the door listening. The wanderers, battered, stiff, and sore, seated themselves at a folding table. While eating, Seaton watched the engine, when he was not watching Dorothy, and talked to her. Crane and Margaret chatted easily. Duquesne, except when addressed directly, maintained a self-sufficient silence. After another observation, Seaton said, "Duquesne, we're almost 5,000 light-years away from Earth and getting farther away at about 1 light-year per minute."
"It'd be poor technique to ask how you know."
"It would. Those figures are right. But we've got only 4 bars of copper left. Enough to stop us, and some to spare, but not nearly enough to get us back, even by drifting. Too many lifetimes on the way."
"So we land somewhere, dig us some copper."
"Check, what I wanted to ask you, isn't a copper-bearing sun apt to have copper-bearing planets?"
"I'd say so."
"Then take the spectroscope, will you? Pick out a sun somewhere up ahead, down ahead, I mean, for us to shoot at. And Mart, I suppose we'd better take our regular 12-hour tricks. No, 8. We've got to either trust the guy or kill him. I'll take the first watch and beat it to bed."
"Not so fast," Crane said. "If I remember correctly, it's my turn.
Ancient history doesn't count. I'll flip you a nickel for it. Heads, I win."
Seaton won, and the worn-out travelers went to their rooms, all except Dorothy, who lingered to bid her lover a more intimate good night. Seated beside him, his arm around her and her head on his shoulder, she sat blissfully until she noticed, for the first time, her bare left hand. She caught her breath and her eyes grew round.
"What's the matter, Red?"
"Oh, Dick,"
she exclaimed in dismay. "I simply forgot everything about taking what was left of my ring out of the doctor's engine."
"Huh? What are you talking about?"
She told him, and he told her about Martin and himself.
"Oh, Dick, Dick, it's so wonderful to be with you again," she concluded. "I lived as many years as we covered miles."
"That was tough. You had it a lot worse than we did. But it makes me ashamed all over to think of the way I blew my stack at Wilson's. If it hadn't been for Martin's cautious old bean, we owe him a lot, Dimples."
"Yes, we do. But don't worry about the debt, Dick. Just don't ever let slip a word to Peggy about Martin being rich is all."
"Oh, matchmaker now? Oh, why not? She wouldn't think any less of him. That's one reason I'm marrying you, you know, for your money."
Dorothy snickered sunnily. "I know, but listen, you poor dumb fortune-hunting darling. If Peggy had any idea that Martin is the one and only M. Reynolds Crane, she'd curl right up into a ball. She'd think, he'd think she was chasing him, and then he would think so. As it is, he acts perfectly natural. Why, he hasn't talked that way to any girl except me for 5 years. And he wouldn't talk to me until he found out for sure I wasn't out after him."
"Could be, pet," Seaton agreed. "On one thing, you really chirped it. He's been shot at so much he's wilder than a hawk."
At the end of 8 hours, Crane took over, and Seaton stumbled to his room, where he slept for over 10 hours like a man in a trance. Then rising, he exercised and went out into the saloon. Dorothy, Peggy, and Crane were at breakfast. Seaton joined them. They ate the gayest, most carefree meal they had had since leaving Earth. Some of the worst bruises still showed a little, but under the influence of the potent, if painful, amylophene, all soreness, stiffness, and pain had disappeared. After they had finished eating, Seaton said,
"You suggested, Mart, that those gyroscope bearings may have been stressed beyond the yield point. I'll take an integrating gnometer and..."
"Break that down to our size, Dick. Peggy's in mine," Dorothy said.
"Can do. Take some tools, see if anything got bent out of shape back there. It might be an idea, Dot, to come along and hold my head while I think."
"That is an idea, if you never have another one."
Crane and Margaret went over and sat down at one of the crystal clear ports. She told him her story, frankly and fully, shuddering with horror, as she recalled the awful helpless fall during which Perkins had been killed.
"We have a heavy score to settle with that steel crowd and with Duquesne," Crane said slowly. "We can convict him of abduction now. Perkins' death wasn't murder then."
"Oh, no. He was just like a mad animal. Oh, he had to kill him. But the doctor, as they call him, is just as bad. He's so utterly heartless and ruthless, so cold and scientific. It gives me the compound shivers just to think about him."
"And yet, Dorothy said he saved her life."
"He did, from Perkins. But that was just as strictly pragmatic as everything else he has ever done. He wanted her alive. Dead, she wouldn't have been of any use to him. He's as nearly a robot as any human being can be. That's what I think."
"I'm inclined to agree with you. Nothing would please Dick better than a good excuse for killing him."
"He isn't the only one, and the way he ignores what we all feel shows what a machine he is. What's that?"
The Skylark had lurched slightly.
"Just a swing around a star, probably."
He looked at the board, then led her to a lower port. "We're passing the star Dick was heading for. Far too fast to stop. Duquesne will pick out another. See that planet over there?" He pointed. "And that smaller one there?" She saw the two planets, one like a small moon, the other much smaller, and watched the sun increase rapidly in size as the Skylark flew on at such a pace that any earthly distance would have been covered as soon as it was begun. So appalling was their velocity that the ship was bathed in the light of that strange sun for only moments, then was surrounded again by darkness. Their 72-hour flight, without a pilot, had seemed a miracle. Now it seemed entirely possible that they could fly in a straight line for weeks without encountering any obstacle. So vast was the emptiness in comparison with the points of light scattered about in it. Now and then they passed closely enough to a star so that it seemed to move fairly rapidly, but for the most part the stars stood like distant mountain peaks to travelers in a train, in the same position for many minutes. Awed by the immensity of the universe, the two at the window were silent, not with the silence of embarrassment, but with that of two friends in the presence of a thing far beyond the reach of words. As they stared out into infinity, each felt as never before the pitiful smallness of the whole world they had known, and the insignificance of human beings and their works. Silently their minds reached out to each other in understanding. Unconsciously, Margaret half shuddered and moved closer to Crane, and a tender look came over Crane's face as he looked down at the beautiful young woman at his side, for she was beautiful. Rest and food had erased the marks of her imprisonment. Dorothy's deep and unassumed faith in the ability of Seton and Crane had quieted her fears. And finally, a costume of Dorothy's, well-made and exceedingly expensive, clothes which fitted her very well and in which she looked her best and knew it, had completely restored her self-possession. He looked up quickly and again studied the stars. But now, in addition to the wonders of space, he saw a mass of wavy black hair, high piled upon a queenly head, deep brown eyes veiled by long black lashes, sweet, sensitive lips, a firmly rounded, dimpled chin, and a beautifully formed young body. "How stupendous, how unbelievably great this is," Margaret whispered. "How vastly greater than any perception one could possibly get on earth. And yet..." She paused with her lip cut under two white teeth and went on hesitatingly. "But doesn't it seem to you, Mr. Crane, that there is something in man as great as even all this? That there must be, or Dorothy and I could not be out here sailing in such a wonderful thing as this skylark which you and Dick Seton have made?" Days passed. Dorothy timed her waking hours with those of Seton, preparing his meals and lightening the tedium of his long vigils at the board, and Margaret did the same thing for Crane. But often they assembled in the saloon, while Duquesne was on watch, and there was much fun and laughter, as well as serious discussion among the four. Margaret, already adopted as a friend, proved a delightful companion. Her ready tongue, her quick, delicate wit, and her facility of expression delighted all three. One day Crane suggested to Seton that they should take notes, in addition to the photographs they had been taking. "I know comparatively little of astronomy, but with the instruments we have, we should be able to get data, especially on planetary systems, which would be of interest to astronomers. Miss Spencer, being a secretary, could help us." "Sure," Seton said. "That's an idea. Why, nobody else ever had a chance to do it before." "I'll be glad to. Taking notes is the best thing I do," Margaret cried and called for pad and pencils. After that, the two worked together for several hours on each of Martin's off shifts. The Skylark passed one solar system after another with a velocity so great that it was impossible to land. Margaret's association with Crane, begun as a duty, became a very real pleasure for them both. Working together in research, sitting together at the board in easy conversation, or in equally easy silence, they compressed into days more real companionship than is usually possible in months. oftener and oftener as time went on, Crane found the vision of his dream home floating in his mind as he steered the Skylark in her meteoric flight, or as he lay strapped into his narrow bunk. Now, however, the central figure of the vision, instead of being a blur, was clear and sharply defined, and for her part, Margaret was drawn more and more to the quiet and unassuming but steadfast young inventor, with his wide knowledge and his keen, incisive mind. The Skylark finally slowed down enough to make a landing possible, and course was laid toward the nearest planet of a copper-bearing sun. As vessel neared planet, a wave of excitement swept through the four of the five. They watched the globe grow larger, glowing white, its outline softened by the atmosphere surrounding it. It had two satellites. Its sun, a great blazing orb, looked so big and so hot that Margaret became uneasy. "Isn't it dangerous to get so close, Dick?" "Uh-uh. Watching the pyrometers is part of the pilot's job. Any overheating, and he'd snatch us away in a hurry." They dropped into the atmosphere and on down almost to the surface. The air was breathable, its composition being very similar to that of Earth's air, except the carbon dioxide was substantially higher. Its pressure was somewhat high, but not too much. Its temperature, while high, was endurable. The planet's gravitational pull was about 10% higher than Earth's. The ground was almost hidden by a rank growth of vegetation, but here and there appeared glade-like openings. Landing upon one of the open spaces, they found the ground solid and stepped out. What appeared to be a glade was in reality a rock, or rather a ledge of apparently solid metal, with scarce a loose fragment to be seen. At one end of the ledge rose a giant tree, wonderfully symmetrical, but of a peculiar form, its branches being longer at the top than at the bottom, and having broad, dark green leaves, long thorns, and odd, flexible, shoot-like tendrils. It stood as an outpost of the dense vegetation beyond. The fern trees, towering 200 feet or more in the air, were totally unlike the forests of Earth. They were an intensely vivid green and stood motionless in the still, hot air. Not a sign of animal life was to be seen. The whole landscape seemed to be asleep. "A younger planet than ours," Duquesne said, "in the Carboniferous or about. Aren't those fern trees like those in the coal measures, Seton?" "Check. I was just trying to think what they reminded me of, but it's this ledge that interests me no end. Whoever heard of a chunk of noble metal this big?"
"How do you know it's noble?" Dorothy asked.
"No corrosion, and it's probably been sitting here for 1,000,000 years. Seton, who had walked over to one of the loose lumps, kicked it with his heavy shoe. It did not move. He bent over to pick it up with one hand. It still did not move. With both hands and all the strength of his back, he could lift it, but that was all. "What do you make of this, Duquesne?" Duquesne lifted the mass, then took out his knife and scraped. He studied the freshly exposed metal and the scrapings, then scraped and studied again.
Platinum group, almost certainly. And the only known member of that group with that peculiar bluish sheen is your X.
But didn't we agree that free X and copper couldn't exist on the same planet? And that planets of copper-bearing suns carry copper?
Yes, but that doesn't make it true. If this stuff is X, it'll give the cosmologists something to fight about for the next 20 years. I'll take these scrapings and run a couple of quickies.
Do that, and I'll gather in these loose nuggets if it's X, and I'm pretty sure it mostly is. Oh, that'll be enough to run all the power plants of Earth for 10,000 years.
Crane and Seton, accompanied by the two girls, rolled the nearer pieces of metal up to the ship. Then, as the quest led them farther and farther afield, Crane protested.
This is none too safe, Dick.
Looks perfectly safe to me, quiet as a...
Margaret screamed. Her head was turned, looking back at the Skylark. Her face was a mask of horror. Seaton drew his pistol as he whirled, only to check his finger on the trigger and lower his hand.
Nothing but explosive bullets, he said, and the four watched a thing come out slowly from behind their ship.
Its four huge, squat legs supported a body at least 100 feet long, pursy and ungainly at the head of a long, sinuous neck. A small head seemed composed entirely of cavernous mouth, armed with row upon row of carnivorous teeth. Dorothy gasped with terror. Both girls shrank closer to the two men, who maintained a baffled silence as the huge beast slid its hideous head along the hull of the vessel.
I can't shoot, Mart. It'd wreck the boat, and if I had any solids, they wouldn't be any good.
No, we'd better hide until it goes away. You two take that ledge. We'll take this one.
Or gets far enough away from the Skylark so we can blow him apart, Seaton added, as with Dorothy close beside him, he dropped behind the low bulwark.
Margaret, her staring eyes fixed upon the monster, remained motionless until Crane touched her gently and drew her down to his side.
Don't be frightened, Peggy. It will go away soon.
I'm not now. Much.
She drew a deep breath.
If you weren't here, though, Martin, I'd be dead of pure fright.
His arm tightened around her, then he forced it to relax.
This was neither the time nor the place. A roll of gunfire came from the Skylark. The creature roared in pain and rage, but was quickly silenced by the stream of 50-caliber machine gun bullets.
"Duquesne's on the job! Let's go!" Seaton cried, and the four rushed up the slope. Making a detour to avoid the writhing body, they plunged through the opening door. Duquesne closed the lock. They huddled together in overwhelming relief as an appalling tumult arose outside. The scene, so quiet a few moments before, was horribly changed. The air seemed filled with hideous monsters. Winged lizards of prodigious size hurtled through the air to crash against the Skylark's armored hull. Flying monstrosities with the fangs of tigers attacked viciously. Dorothy screamed and started back as a scorpion-like thing, 10 feet in length, leaped at the window in front of her, its terrible sting spraying the quartz with venom. As it fell to the ground, a spider, if an eight-legged creature with spines instead of hair, faceted eyes, and a bloated globular body weighing hundreds of pounds may be called a spider, leaped upon it, and mighty mandibles against terrible sting, a furious battle raged. 12-foot cockroaches climbed nimbly across the fallen timber of the morass and began feeding voraciously on the carcass of the creature Duquesne had killed. They were promptly driven away by another animal, a living nightmare of that reptilian age, which apparently combined the nature and disposition of Tyrannosaurus rex with a physical shape approximating that of the saber-toothed tiger. This newcomer towered 15 feet high at the shoulders and had a mouth disproportionate even to his great size, a mouth armed with sharp fangs 3 feet in length. He had barely begun his meal, however, when he was challenged by another nightmare, a thing shaped more or less like a crocodile. The crocodile charged. The tiger met him head on, fangs front and rending claws outstretched, clawing, striking, tearing savagely, an avalanche of bloodthirsty rage. The combatants stormed up and down the little island. Suddenly the great tree bent over and lashed out against both animals. It transfixed them with its thorns, which the watchers now saw were both needle-pointed and barbed. It ripped at them with its long branches, which were, in fact, highly lethal spears. The broad leaves, equipped with sucking discs, wrapped themselves around the hopelessly impaled victims. The long, slender twigs or tendrils, each of which now had an eye at its extremity, waved about at a safe distance.
After absorbing all of the two gladiators that was absorbable, the tree resumed its former position, motionless, in all its strange, outlandish beauty. Dorothy licked her lips, which were almost as white as her face.
"I think I'm going to be sick," she remarked conversationally.
"No, you aren't." Seaton tightened his arm. "Chin up, Ace."
"Okay, Chief. Maybe not this time."
Color began to reappear on her cheeks.
"Miss Dick, will you please blow up that horrible tree? It wouldn't be so bad if it were ugly like the rest of the things, but it's so beautiful."
"I sure will. I think we'd better get out of here. This is no place to start a copper mine, even if there is any copper here, which there probably isn't. It is X to Quesney, isn't it?"
"Yes, 99%+ at least."
"Well, that reminds me," Seaton turned it to Quesney, hand outstretched. "You squared it, Blackie. Say the word, the war is all off."
Duquesne ignored the hand.
"Not on my side," he said evenly. "I act as one of the party as long as I'm with you. When we get back, however, I still intend to take both of you out of circulation."
He went to his room.
"Well, I'll be a—"
Seaton bit off a word.
"He ain't a man. He's a cold-blooded fish."
"He's a machine, a robot," Margaret declared. "I always thought so. And now I know it."
"We'll pull his cork when we get back," Seaton said. "He asks for it, and we'll give him both barrels."
Crane went to the board, and soon they were approaching another planet, which was surrounded by a dense fog. Descending slowly, they found it to be a mass of boiling hot steam and rank vapor under enormous pressure. The next planet looked barren and dead. Its atmosphere was clear, but of a peculiar yellowish-green color. Analysis showed over 90% chlorine. No life of any earthly type could exist naturally upon such a world, and a search for copper, even in spacesuits, would be extremely difficult, if not impossible.
"Well," Seaton said as they were once more in space, "we've got copper enough to visit quite a few more solar systems if we have to. But there's a nice hopeful-looking planet right over there. It may be the one we're looking for."
Arriving in the belt of atmosphere, they tested it as before and found it satisfactory.
Please join me next time for another exciting chapter of The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Meanwhile, watch the skies. Thank you.